This is the first day of this June 2018 7-day session. I'm going to read from an anthology called The Original Face, an anthology of Rinzai Zen. It strikes me that one of the things that has come out in the annual meeting of Zen teachers is the awareness that other Zen centers think of us as a Rinzai Zen center. You know, in Japan, there are two schools of Zen, the Rinzai and the Soto. I learned early on that people considered us Rinzai, I guess because of the very vigorous tone of the three pillars of Zen. The Rinzai school emphasizes the need to awaken to our true nature. The Soto school emphasizes more that we've always been, we've never been without this enlightened nature. So it's the difference is just on one of emphasis that the Rinzai school would of course say that we are all originally enlightened, same as the Soto school, but puts more importance on actually realizing that innate enlightenment. But our predecessors in this school of Kaplo Roshi and his predecessors would say that this is an integral Zen. It's what our Dharma grandfather and his Dharma father tried to do is to integrate the best of both schools with a clear recognition, acknowledgement that we all are endowed with this enlightened nature from beginningless time, but yet also not letting it go at that, but emphasizing the importance of awakening to that. And so we alternate or somewhat we rotate in these Teisho texts, Sesshin texts between the Rinzai and the Soto. This one's a Rinzai text. And we're going to turn to Zen Master Daikaku's treatise on sitting meditation. A little bit about this Zen Master Daikaku, which means great enlightenment. His dates are 1213 to 1279. So he was a contemporary of the great Soto Zen master Dogen, Eihei Dogen. But the Daikaku is the Japanized version of his name. This is a Chinese master, this so-called Daikaku. His Chinese name given here is, they have a couple of names. One of the things you have to get used to with Zen masters' names is that any one master may have two or three different names by which he's referred. This one, it's you take your pick, Rankei Doryu. I guess that's another Japanese name, but his Chinese name is Lan Shi Daolong. So he was Chinese. He was born and began his practice in Western China. That's unusual. The Western China. It's most of these guys, these Chinese masters, were in the northeast or the southeast of China. There's the West. After he studied Buddhist sutras in various places, let me give credit here to the translators and editors. This is Thomas Cleary translated and edited this collection, this anthology, and I'm reading from Cleary's introduction. After studying Buddhist sutras in various places, he trained under several Chan masters, finally realizing enlightenment. He heard that Zen was not well known in Japan, even though other teaching traditions of Buddhism were flourishing there already. So he crossed the sea, the Japan Sea, with several of his disciples. He was just 33 at the time. And then he spent another 33 years teaching in Japan. And he died at the age of 66, leaving some 24 enlightened successors. His treatise on meditation strongly emphasizes what may be called the round and sudden aspect of Zazen as realization. All right, now that's all we have about Daikaku. So let's turn to his treatise on sitting meditation. It begins, "Sitting meditation is the method of great liberation. All the teachings flow forth from this. Myriad practices are mastered this way. Supernormal powers, knowledge, wisdom, and virtue all arise from here. The path of life of humans and gods opens herein. All the Buddhas have entered and left by this door. Bodhisattvas practicing it have entered this door. Whatever esoteric or exoteric schools do not practice this, do not have anyone who realizes the way of Buddhahood." So it's important to remember in his references to sitting meditation that he really means sitting meditation and that meditation extended, that mind of meditation extended into activity. They never are just talking about Zen practice as sitting only. I hear people from time to time say, "Well, I don't really sit all that much, but I maintain this mind of awareness and concentration in my daily life." No, you don't. You don't as much as you would if you were sitting every day. Come on. The only way we stand a chance of keeping the mind centered and grounded, alert, responsive, aware, the only way we stand a chance of doing that in our daily lives is by sitting some each day. You may tell yourself that you're doing Zen practice without the sitting, but I don't buy it. Sure, it's better than nothing. It's worth trying to do that. It's worth making the effort. It's wonderful. It's a little hard for me to believe that someone who can't find a way to sit on a daily basis finds a way to maintain this centeredness in their daily life. So this is really the kind of the hallmark of Zen Buddhism as compared to other forms of Buddhism: Tibetan Buddhism, Nichiren Buddhism, Pure Land Buddhism, Vipassana Buddhism. This is the hallmark, is this emphasis on sitting and then the extension of that into daily life. We hear this from Hakuin. We just recited the Hakuin chant, Zen Master Hakuin's chant and praises of Zen, where we say, "Upholding the precepts," okay, that's good, upholding the precepts, "repentance, giving, dana, the countless good deeds, the way of right living, all come from Zazen." was once in a Buddhist conference. I can't remember where. It may have been the one I went to with the Dalai Lama at his place in Dharamsala, where I got wind of a certain attitude on the part of Tibetan Buddhists that Zen is inferior because there's just this one practice. Whereas in Tibetan Buddhism, as I understand, there are many kinds of practices. There's not just meditation, sitting and moving meditation, but also various kinds of prayer and visualization practices and chanting and other things. But here, we hear from Daikaku that there's nothing, we don't need to apologize for this whittling it down, distilling it down to this one practice of sitting. And of course, in Sesshin, here in Sesshin, we bring this to life. And we find that just through sitting, yes, some chanting, prostrations, a little bit of that mixed in, but primarily from sitting is how we change. That's how we transform ourselves. We don't need a lot of different kinds of meditation. There's breath practice, there's koan practice, there's shikantaza. I would, though, push back against what Daikaku says here. Whatever esoteric or exoteric schools do not practice this, do not have anyone who realizes the way of Buddhahood. Maybe he's right. It sounds a little bit sectarian, that it's kind of absolute statement. After all, there are people who've come to awakening who've never even sat or heard of Zen or Buddhism. There are rare cases of spontaneous awakening. And then we have here a question. What does it mean that sitting meditation is the root source of all the teachings? Daikaku. Meditation is the inner mind of the enlightened ones. Discipline is their outer character. Doctrine is their speech. Buddha remembrance is the invocation of Buddha's name. All come from the enlightened mind of the Buddhas. Therefore, it is considered fundamental. Meditation is the inner mind of the enlightened ones. Well, that is, when we are sitting in accord with our true nature, that is, when we're sitting without involvement in our thoughts, this is the inner mind of the enlightened ones. And when we embody this no-mindedness, that is, mind unattached to thought, then our character reflects that in upholding the precepts. This reference to Buddha remembrance is the invocation of the Buddha's name. I don't know anything about that. That's the Pure Land School calling the Buddha's name. Can't speak from experience about that. Question. The method of meditation is formless and thoughtless. Spiritual qualities are not obvious, and there is no proof of seeing reality. So how can we believe in this? Answer. Your own mind and the enlightened mind are one. Is that not spiritual quality? If you don't know your own mind, on whom can you call for witness and proof? Other than the identity of mind and Buddha, what proof do you seek? The the identity of mind and Buddha. There are koans that emphasize this non-dual nature of mind and what we call Buddha. There is no Buddha outside of mind, to put it very simply. My guest, Zen Master Matsu Baso, said, "What is Buddha? This very mind is Buddha." This, and the questioner, when he says spiritual qualities are not obvious, I'm not sure what he's getting at. Maybe he means that in Zen, the sign of a truly developed person is her or his ordinariness, transparency, simplicity. Nothing exotic, no auras. Even charisma is regarded with suspicion in Zen, because it means there's still something special there. What's special is to be ordinary from a Zen perspective. Centered, grounded, free of notions about what is spiritual. And when the questioner says there's no proof of seeing reality, well, no, there's no empirical proof. But this isn't science. Questioner, how can the ability to cultivate the teaching of one mind compare to myriad practices cultivating myriad virtues? Okay, I just touched on that with sort of the difference between Zen and, or one difference between Zen and Tibetan Buddhism. Myriad practices cultivating myriad virtues, or the teaching of one mind. Answer: when you suddenly awaken to the pure, clear meditation of those who realize thusness, the six transcendences and myriad practices are complete within your body. Thus, the one practice of meditation includes all practices. Haven't you heard it said that the three realms are only one mind, that outside of mind there is nothing else? Even if you do cultivate myriad practices, if you don't know the mind, you cannot realize enlightenment. And how can there be any way to fulfill the way of the Buddha if you don't realize enlightenment? My understanding is that cultivating these various practices in Tibetan Buddhism, just to continue to use that as a comparison, cultivating those different practices does develop you in a certain way. It is a way of refining the personality, developing compassion. These things, of course, have much value. But in Zen, the emphasis is on first seeing into one's nature, seeing the, what in Zen we call the fundamental ground, the essence. First seeing the essence, realizing the essence. And then after that, working on these other practices in a different way than in Tibetan Buddhism. Working on koans subsequent to one's first koan is one of those ways, one of those ways of refining one's character, developing patience, humility. Question: how should we practice this method? Even if we practice, we are not sure of attaining enlightenment and fulfilling Buddhahood. And if it is uncertain, even if we do practice, what is the benefit? Then the answer, Daikaku. This school, that is Zen, is an exceedingly deep and subtle teaching. Once you have heard it, it becomes an excellent cause for enlightenment for all time. An ancient said, "Those who hear this, even if they don't believe, have blessings greater than humans or gods. Those who practice even without attainment eventually reach enlightenment." This reference to humans and gods, it's a common pairing of the higher states of unenlightened existence. These are the top two of the six realms of unenlightened existence. So often the teachers, masters will hold these up as by comparison to other things. Don't know who the ancient is. He's quoting this ancient who said, "Those who hear this, even if they don't believe, have blessings greater than humans or gods." It's quite a statement. Those who hear this teaching, either hear it in the form of a talk, or hear it in the form of one of the sutras that we chant, like the Prajnaparamita, the heart of perfect wisdom. Those who hear the Dharma, even if they don't believe it, have blessings greater than humans or gods. And all the more so then, those who practice it, even short of awakening. Daikaku then says, "This teaching is the school of the enlightened mind. The enlightened mind itself basically has no delusion or enlightenment." Let me just pause there. What we are calling, what Daikaku is calling the enlightened mind, is our true mind. It's our essential nature. And it is beyond this dichotomy of enlightenment or no enlightenment. He says, "This is actually the subtle art of those who realize thusness. Even if you don't become enlightened, when you sit once in meditation, you are a Buddha for that sitting. When you sit for a day in meditation, you're a Buddha for a day. And when you sit in meditation all your life, you are a Buddha all your life. The same is true of the future. One who can have faith in this is someone with great potential." So faith, that he mentions faith that in our sitting, if we're not just lost in our thoughts, if in our sitting we are realizing, we are embodying this true nature of ours, even short of awakening to it, we are manifesting it in our sitting and in our active zazen of no thought. So there's this saying in Japan, a minute of sitting, a minute of being a Buddha. But what's implied there is not just sitting and daydreaming. Anyone can sit and daydream. People do it. Half of the world, most of the world, every day sits on their front porch or on a train or somewhere else and daydreams. That's not what he's talking about. But sitting detached from thoughts, concentrated. Question, if so, I can practice too. How should I rest my mind? How should I use my mind? Daikaku, the enlightened mind has no attachment to appearances. Detachment from appearances is the character of reality. Appearances here, you could also read that as particulars. You can also read it as thoughts. This put in particulars. The enlightened mind has no attachment to particulars. That means any specific, limited particulars. Detachment from particulars is the character of reality. In other words, it's not bound to any particular method. Among the four modes of conduct, and this is also just a standard formula in Zen, the four modes of conduct are walking, standing, sitting, and lying down. Sitting is considered to be stable and tranquil. This means sitting straight and contemplating the characteristics of reality. Well, sitting straight, because we're more likely to keep the mind free of thoughts, the impediment of thought, the obstruction of thought, if we're sitting with good alignment, upright. Let's review that, what that means, the basics of Zen sitting. It starts at the bottom with a solid, stable foundation. In one of these several postures that we sit in, cross-legged or kneeling on a bench or straddling a cushion, or sitting in a chair, feet flat on the floor. So stability. Stability is the key in our sitting. And then from that foundation, that stable foundation, then to stretch up the spine, lengthening the back of the neck, even while relaxing the shoulders. So there's a toned quality to it. There is a taut quality. You're not letting the back sag, but you're keeping it, stretching it up. And then relaxing the shoulders. Shoulders have to be relaxed, completely relaxed. Keeping the upper chest up, or at least keeping the upper chest from sinking or caving in. The upper chest is open. But the spine, the backbone, this is the center pole of a tent. Think of a big festival tent. Get that pole upright, straight, and then the rest, the canvas of the tent, can relax, can be without bones to it, just relaxing. As long as that backbone is straight, stretched up. And it, as much as possible, to have the pelvis tilted forward at the base, rather than letting the lower back get rounded and turned under. So it means when sitting down, taking your position and for a round of sitting, to thrust the buttocks out behind you to get that pelvic tilt. And this helps one sit with greater ease. Question. Please explain in detail the meaning of sitting straight and contemplating reality. Oh, here he goes. He runs through some of these same points. Sitting straight means sitting cross-legged as the Buddhas do. Contemplating reality means sitting meditation, forming the symbol of absorption in the cosmos. There's a footnote there. The symbol of absorption in the cosmos means placing both palms up, the left hand and the right palm, the thumb tips touching lightly. This is a little detail that can make a bit of a difference in one's concentration. Rather than pressing the thumb tips together, just having them touch very lightly, just the tips of the thumbs touching, so that there is an oval form, more or less. The hand positions can be difficult to get right because we have to be sure that the hands are resting, that they're supported. If they're not supported by your heels in full lotus, or your at least one of the heels, then there has to be some way to have them resting, not holding them up. And this also enables the body-mind, to be more at rest. I'll finish saying what the footnote says. Thumb tips joined to form a circle, symbol of the body of reality with no lack or excess, beginningless and endless, perfect and complete as a sphere. So in traditional calligraphy in East Asia, this would be the enso, the circle. And so we form a kind of enso with the hands. If you find that it just doesn't work, you can't seem to make it work to hold the hands in this oval position with the thumb tips touching lightly, it's okay to just clasp one hand with the other. But I've never found that it had quite the same power in bringing the mind to a fine point of concentration as does this other mudra. Mudra means hand position. But he continues in answering this question, what is the meaning of sitting straight? Body and mind unmoving. Okay, let's just review that, folks. Why do we sit without moving for 35 minutes at a time? Number one, so we're not distracting people near us, our neighbors, with our fidgeting. This is the main reason. And then number two, we sit without moving because the more still we can be physically, the more likely we're going to be able to bring the mind to a state of stillness. Body and mind unmoving, eyes half open. This is very important that they don't let the eyes close. especially in these first two or three days of Sesshin, when people are more susceptible to drowsiness, you want to be sure your eyes are open, not wide open, but open enough that that your gaze falls on the wall about a couple feet up, more or less. You don't want your gaze at the base of the wall. That's too low. They're mostly closed that way. But up a little bit, foot and a half, 2 feet, 2.5 feet. If you're tall, even 3 feet, it could be where your gaze falls on the wall. This lets enough light in on the retina to keep the mind, help keep the mind a little more alert. Eyes half open. You should see all compounded things, that means all phenomena, physical phenomena and mental phenomena, as like dreams, illusions, bubbles, shadows. This is a reference to a sutra, a very famous passage in a sutra, that all phenomena, physical and non-physical, all phenomena have this evanescent quality, that dreams, illusions, bubbles, and shadows have. And then he says, don't get hung up in thought about them. Oh, and then the question, crossing the legs and making the symbol with the hands, that is the oval, is the comportment of the realized ones, but why keep the eyes half open? Answer, when the eyes are fully open and you can see for a distance, your mind can be distracted by the profusion of objects. Yet if you close your eyes, you fall into a state of darkness and oblivion, and your mind is not clear. Whereas when your eyes are half open, your thoughts don't race. Mind and body are one thusness. When you examine clearly, the afflictions of birth and death cannot be approached. This is called fulfilling Buddhahood right where you are, the meaning of great capacity and great function. So, keeping the eyes half open then enables us to settle, enables the mind to settle more easily when they're only half open, and while at the same time staying awake, not letting them close all the way. I think this is a good point to stop, so we'll now recite the four vows. All beings without number, endless blind passions, I vow to uproot Dharma gaze beyond measure. I vow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I vow to attain all beings without number. I vow to liberate endless blind passions, I bow to uproot Dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions, I vow
avrut, dharma gates beyond measure, I now do penetrate the written way of Buddha, I vow to attain.